Hello there. Today is Wednesday, June 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Donald Trump gives a 40-minute rant that took aim at the media. Reports of civilians in the crossfire of fighting in Fallujah being used as human shields. Mediterranean Sea disasters leave more than 1,000 dead, and will warmer seas mean more shark attacks?
More people equals more chance for attacks.
And actors in the spotlight for all the wrong reasons. It's all ahead today on International Edition. And we begin with the U.S. presidential campaign under pressure to account for money he said he raised for veterans. Donald Trump held a press conference in New York Tuesday where the presumptive Republican presidential nominee blasted the news media for pressing the issue.
I'm the only one in the world could raise almost $6 million for the veterans, have uniform applause by the veterans groups, and end up being criticized by the press.
Trump saying a fundraiser he held last January at the same time as a Fox News GOP debate he was boycotting raised $5.6 million, and he repeatedly disparaged reporters who had inquired for months about the amount raised and who it had actually gone to. His campaign had offered conflicting answers, apparently, in recent weeks.
Excuse me, I've watched you on television. You're a real beauty. When I raise money for the veterans, and it's a massive amount of money, find out how much Hillary Clinton's given to the veterans. Nothing.
Clinton, meanwhile, landed a coveted endorsement from California Governor Jerry Brown on Tuesday, patching up a strained relationship between the two Democrats as she seeks to deliver one final blow to Bernie Sanders' campaign. Now, Clinton heads into California and the other end-of-the-line primaries on June 7th, that's next week, with the Democratic nomination virtually locked up. She just needs 71 delegates to reach the required threshold at the party's summer convention in Philadelphia. Now let's turn to our social media segment to see what's trending online. International Edition's G. Abby Lee joins me. G, I understand that Stephen Hawking, who of course was the subject of the 2014 motion picture The Theory of Everything, is actually causing some buzz online today.
Hi, Lori. Stephen Hawking, who is one of the most respected physicists of our time, did an interview with UK's ITV. He answered a wide range of questions from Brexit to international politics. When the host asked him for possible reasons behind Trump's popularity, he answered he can't think of any.
Really? What exactly did he say?
He said Trump is a demagogue who seems to appeal to the lowest common denominator. CNN, MSNBC, and The Washington Post are all talking about it on various social media platforms. And as you know, these media outlets are not rooting for Trump. So let's check out some of the comments online. One of the most liked comments to the MSNBC post reads, "Hawking may be this generation's most brilliant mind, but you don't have to be particularly brilliant to determine Trump's lowest common denominator strategy." Under the CNN post, the most popular comment defends Trump. More than 1,000 people liked this comment. This just goes to show that many so-called geniuses rarely display intelligence outside their respective fields of expertise.
Interesting. So how significant is Hawking's comment?
He has a lot of influence on important topics such as climate change and the Middle East conflict, and he's known to be quite opinionated. He communicates using a computerized voice that pronounces words he spelt out a letter at a time, so that takes a lot of effort, which means his opinion should be counted as carefully considered in advance. You can also connect with him on Twitter. His handle is at StephenHawking8. He joined Twitter on August 2010 and sent out 10 tweets so far, all of them in that year. And even though he tweeted only 10 times, he has almost 44,000 followers. So he didn't have to go through all the efforts that we go through, Lori and I, to get all these followers. So that's all for me today.
All right. Thanks so much, G. And you can follow her at G. Abby Lee. We also invite you to follow us here at International Edition at VOA underscore IE. Here are some of the other stories we are following at voanews.com. The U.S. issues a travel warning for Europe. Saudi and Pakistani men advised on how to beat their wives. A former police officer in the U.S. found guilty of murder for hire. There's been a dramatic rise in the number of Afghans displaced by the conflict. And court documents offer a glimpse into Trump University. You can find expanded coverage of these stories and much more on voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. That is the sound of intense fighting as Iraqi forces move to retake the city of Fallujah from the Islamic State group. Security forces in Iraq launched an operation on Monday to retake the city, storming the stronghold from several points. Now, there is a toll to those caught in the crossfire. UN Refugee Agency is hearing reports of civilians being killed by heavy shelling and some even being buried alive under the rubble of their homes. Many others are trying desperately to get out. According to Lisa Grande, the deputy special representative of the United Nations Assistance Mission for Iraq.
We also are receiving very credible reports that families are being concentrated and forced into the center of the city by Daesh, and they're not allowed to leave these concentration points. And that would suggest that Daesh could be using them or may intend to use them as some kind of a human shield.
She says the agency's estimates that are that there are close to 50,000 civilians who are now trapped in the city. And she says there is a major food shortage and reports of horrific human suffering for civilians unable to escape.
And the families that have made it out, what they're telling us is that they've been forced to drink water from the irrigation canals. This is dirty, unsafe water. Cholera is endemic to this part of Iraq.
Pro-government forces are reporting many IS fighters have been killed, but some have been captured alive and are providing information. Fallujah, a Sunni stronghold, has been held by IS longer than any other city in Iraq, and the fighters are believed to be deeply entrenched in the city. This is International Edition. The UN Refugee Agency is voicing concern at the rising death toll among refugees and migrants crossing the Mediterranean Sea, especially along the route from Libya to Italy. UNHCR spokesman William Spindler says boats leaving from Libya are terribly overcrowded, putting people's lives at risk. And he says smugglers are reportedly increasing the number of people on board these boats to maximize income before the start of the holy month of Ramadan in the coming week.
Thus far, 2016 is proving to be particularly deadly. Some 2,510 lives have been lost so far compared to 1,855 in the same period in 2015.
Spindler says smugglers are packing people onto boats that are barely even seaworthy.
This highlights the importance of rescue operations as part of the response to the movement of refugees and migrants in the Mediterranean and the need for real, safer alternatives for people needing international protection.
Well, this past week has been particularly deadly when it comes to these migrants. A series of shipwrecks on the Mediterranean reportedly claimed as many as 1,000 lives. Humanitarian organizations have been circulating a photo of a German rescue worker holding a drowned baby to persuade European authorities to take action on the ongoing tragedy. So how's life treating you? Well, it is definitely better in some places than others. The Better Life Index is designed to compare some of the key factors like education, housing, environment, and so on that contribute to well-being. And this year's findings, just released by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, VOA's Susan Yackey spoke to Romina Borini, a senior economist and head of the Measuring Well-Being Unit, who talked about the most important ingredients to well-being, according to their research.
What we find is that in all OECD countries and many other countries of the world, health and job are really important aspects of well-being and quality of life. So we're measuring quality of jobs, for instance, not just in terms, you know, how many jobs exist in a country, but also how good these jobs are. And we see that this has a really, really lot of importance for having a good life.
In which countries is life satisfaction at its lowest?
This year, what we see is that at South Africa, the country that is coming up with the lowest life satisfaction level, and in general, life satisfaction is also low in some European Eastern countries, but also in Turkey, for instance.
And what about the warring countries like Syria, Iraq, those parts of the world?
Well, we're actually not covering those countries, but we know from other studies that life satisfaction is very low in those countries too.
Well, where do all the happy people live?
Most of the happy people live in north of Europe. Norway this year is the country with the largest number of happy people. But we see that life satisfaction is also high in Switzerland and in other Nordic countries.
Is there a difference between men and women in levels of happiness? I know between my husband and I, I'm much more optimistic.
Well, we see a few differences, but this is not really, really very big. I would say, you know, it depends very much on the country where you live in. And in general, we don't see strong patterns in terms of differences in life satisfaction, you know, for women and men. But what we actually do see is that there are things that differ, you know, that have different importance according to women and men. So we actually also ask the people to tell us what are the most important aspects of their life. And there we can see, for instance, that women tend to find that things that is work-life balance, but also community, really are very, very important to their lives. While, for instance, men tend to say that income or jobs are more important drivers of their well-being.
Generally, around the planet, are there more happy people or more unhappy people?
I would say, unfortunately, there are more unhappy people if you have to consider all, you know, poor countries and emerging countries. But we also see some, you know, levels of happiness, and I think this is very positive in the sense that we know, we start to understand what is the good recipe for a better life. And so it is really important, I think, to spread the message that, you know, a better life is possible for everybody.
How is the OECD going to use this information?
We're actually using it in a lot of our policy reports. So we are giving recommendations to countries how they can improve concretely, very concretely, the lives of their citizens. For instance, when we see that in countries, work-life balance is not particularly well done, then in these cases, we tell countries to help individuals in terms of, you know, managing better their work and their life needs. For instance, we tell them to introduce childcare facilities, to introduce flexible wartime arrangements, all those sorts of things that really help people to strike better balance between the work and the life. So we're giving a lot of recommendations. This is not just measuring for the sake of measuring, but actually try to understand how countries and our governments can change the way they function to make sure that this is going to lead to better lives for all citizens.
And that was economist Romina Borini talking about the just-released Better Life Index with VOA's Susan Yackey. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This is International Edition. In 1966, New York Senator Robert F. Kennedy made a historic visit to apartheid South Africa, making what many scholars consider the best speech of his life. But half a century later, on the anniversary of his visit, his words still resonate. A delegation of Kennedy family members are touring South Africa to mark the occasion. VOA's Anita Powell followed part of the anniversary tour and brings us this report from Johannesburg.
Each time a man stands up for an ideal or acts to improve the lot of others, or strikes out against injustice, he sends forth a tiny ripple of hope, and crossing each other from a million different centers of energy and daring, Those ripples build a current which can sweep down the mightiest walls of oppression and resistance.
Robert F. Kennedy delivered those hopeful, defiant words in a very different South Africa. In 1966, the nation seemed concretely locked into the racist apartheid system. The powerful speeches he delivered over his four-day visit raised hopes that the entrenched system might one day end, and his meetings with top anti-apartheid leaders directly defied the nation's leaders. But 50 years later, the senator's words still resonate on both sides of the Atlantic Ocean. Race, equality, and social justice are still major issues in both South Africa and the U.S. Both nations are facing elections later this year. South Africa will hold municipal polls. And these issues have, predictably, raised their thorny heads and inspired unpleasant political rhetoric. Kennedy's daughter, Carrie, a human rights activist, says although she believes race relations have improved in both the U.S. and in South Africa, after all, she said, apartheid is over, and her father played a central role in passing the U.S. Civil Rights Act of 1964, change doesn't come from above.
All those changes took place not because governments wanted them to. Governments tried to stop them, and not because militaries wanted them to. Militaries tried to stop them, and not because huge multinational corporations wanted them to. Multinational corporations tried to stop them, including South Africa. All those changes took place because small groups of determined people harnessed the dream of freedom and made it come true. That's what creates change.
Kennedy's words, delivered this week at Johannesburg's University of the Witwatersrand, found a receptive audience among many young South Africans who have recently expressed disgust as their politicians are mired in scandal after scandal, and millions of people say they have yet to experience the economic equality they were promised when apartheid ended two decades ago. But Kennedy said, when times are dark, one thing always shines through, hope. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Well, coming up, a very big Hollywood actor with a brand new movie out is in the news for all the wrong reasons. But first, a 12-year-old boy was severely injured by a shark bite over the weekend in Neptune, Florida. And then today we're hearing that a 29-year-old surfer is in critical condition and has lost a leg in a shark attack off an Australian West Coast beach. Now, these incidents come as some are raising concerns that warming waters could increase the number of incidents involving sharks and humans. But there may be more to it. I talked about the reality of the situation with George Burgess. He is the director of the International Shark Attack File at the University of Florida.
We can expect more of those coming up here. We started off with the holiday weekend this past weekend, and there were three such incidents over the weekend. So more people equals more chance for attacks, and we'll be seeing more of that as the summer goes on.
Now, is this expected to be a higher number this year than last year? Are shark bites on the rise? And if so, why?
Yes, we would expect every year to have more attacks than the last, simply because there are more humans on the face of the earth each year than the previous year, and with it comes a concurrent increase in the number of hours spent in the sea by humans. Of course, from year to year, there are variations that occur that alter those expectations, things such as oceanographic conditions, meteorological conditions, biological conditions, and, of course, socioeconomic conditions that affect how many people go in the water. So all of those things will come into play. But if all those were the same year in and year out, we would expect an increase in the number of bites each year.
Does any of this have to do with global warming? Is that changing the climate out there for sharks and shark bites and behavior?
The global climate change is playing a small effect as well. The warming of our air and water temperatures, we could expect that sharks, which are primarily warm water animals, are more likely to occur in areas to the north in our hemisphere, to the south in the southern hemisphere, and also will be there for a longer period. That is, they'll arrive earlier in the spring and perhaps stay later in the fall as those temperatures are retained. And, of course, last year was an El Nino year, a year of oceanographic occurrence that increases the water temperature, and we're at the trail end of the El Nino right now, and that plays a small part as well.
Is there a specific location on the globe where there are more frequent shark bites or where the shark bites are more likely to occur?
Shark bites are more likely to occur in areas where there are increased human utilization or activity. And so it comes no surprise that that Florida, which has the third largest population of any state in the United States and the largest tourist population probably of any place in the world, each year we see about 20 or so bites in Florida waters. And the area that's primarily affected is the east coast of Florida, the ocean coast, which is the area that hosts the most people. And, of course, it's also the area where the surf is the best, and that attracts surfers, which are the number one target group of shark bite.
What would you tell folks out there that are getting ready for their beach vacations this summer if they were concerned about potential sharks in the waters?
Well, although we hear about shark attack, the actual rate of attack, the number of bites divided by the number of people that go in the water, is actually declining, and our odds as individuals of being bitten, far less dying, have never been lower. On average, over the last decade, only six people die each year worldwide from shark attack. And when you consider the billions upon billions of hours spent in the sea by people around the world, to only have six fatalities, it gives you a pretty good indication of how rare the phenomenon is.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your insights. That was George Burgess, director of the International Shark Attack File at the University of Florida. Turning to the world of Hollywood, lots of buzz about one particular actor whose wife just gave a deposition to police about abuse allegations. Joining me to talk about it, Entertainment Tonight senior editor Jennifer Perros. Hi, Jen. What exactly are you hearing?
Obviously, the big story that everybody has been talking about almost for the past week is Johnny Depp and his split from his wife of just 15 months, Amber Heard. And there's been a lot of back and forth between the two actors, kind of a he said, she said, what's the real truth? And now we're just really starting to realize that there's basically three sides to the story: his version, her version, and the truth. So what we know so far, we had just confirmed on ET Online, is I'm sure you remember when Johnny had broken his hand March of last year while he was filming Pirates of the Caribbean 5 out mm-hmm. in Australia. Everybody, it was this mysterious hand injury, and the movie studio basically confirmed and released a statement that something happened off set where Johnny broke his hand and he needed to fly to the United States for last-minute surgery. And what we have just confirmed today from multiple sources is that Johnny actually had injured his hand from punching a wall during an argument with Amber. We know that, you know, production was halted for about a month. Amber then had left Australia to head to London to film The Danish Girl. So I think there's a lot more things that are going to come out of this nasty split, and I don't think it's going to quiet down anytime soon.
Wow, so sad all the way around.
It really is sad. And, you know, a lot of people close to Johnny are coming to his defense. I mean, his ex-girlfriend and the mother of his children, Vanessa Paradis, had come out this past weekend in a letter to TMZ and said, you know, Johnny had never physically, verbally attacked me at all. He was never violent towards me or our children. I had never seen that side of him. And then Johnny's daughter, Lily Rose, who we hear is a very close friend of Amber's, said, you know, my father would never hurt a fly. He is the nicest man I've ever met. So a lot more interesting things to come out of this story, I'm sure, in the near future.
Any other big stories you guys are working on?
Yeah, you know, today, again, more sad news. I'm so sorry. More sad news out of Los Angeles. Of course, the former S.H.I.E.L.D. actor Michael Jace was finally convicted this morning after a week-long trial of second-degree murder of his wife, April. So a jury in Los Angeles had convicted him guilty today. We are hearing that the incident happened in front of the couple's two young children 2 years ago. There was a lot of back and forth of what really happened. You know, Michael had said it kind of was, he took a he took a shotgun out and just wanted to shoot her in the leg to scare her a little bit, and that turned into three shots that eventually killed her. So an incredibly sad story, something that two young children should never have to see, and the famous actor was finally found guilty. And he's going to appear court for sentencing on June 10th, and he could face 40 years to life in a state prison. Okay, so some good stuff on ET Online, such as, you know, how the celebrities celebrated their Memorial Day weekend here in the U.S., and some great fashion from Amal Clooney meeting the Pope as well from this past weekend.
All right. Nice to end it on a happier note. Entertainment Tonight senior editor Jennifer Peros. You can read more about that story and lots more on entertainment at etonline.com.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new astronomical discovery just might change long-held ideas of how long it takes for large planets, such as our solar system's outer planets, to form. Scientists have long thought that it takes large planets at least 10 million years to form. But the astronomers say the discovery of Ci Tau B, that's at least 8 times larger than Jupiter, circles a star that's thought to be only 2 million years old. At that time on Earth, the first members of the genus Homo, which now includes modern humans, began to appear in the fossil record. By comparison, Earth and the Sun are about 4.5 billion years old. The star, Ci Tau, is so young that it's still circled by a disk of circumstellar gas and dust that can provide material to form new planets. The astronomers say that Ci Tau B orbits its star every 9 days. The star system is about 450 light years away. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Thanks so much for tuning in to International Edition. We'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. Thanks so much to our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have yourself a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Law enforcement and the rule of law in Pakistan got a boost recently with some assistance from the United States. Last month, U.S. Ambassador to Pakistan David Hale and Pakistan Economic Affairs Division Secretary Tariq Bajwa signed a one-year $48.6 million bilateral assistance agreement. Under the agreement, the U.S. Department of State's International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs Bureau will provide support to the government of Pakistan in building Pakistan's law enforcement capability, fighting illicit narcotics, and strengthening its criminal justice system. The United States signed the first such bilateral assistance agreement in 1982. Subsequent yearly agreements have supported the training of tens of thousands of police officers and prosecutors, construction of police stations, and provision of vehicles, equipment, and life-saving personal protective gear for law enforcement agents. The new agreement will fund several programs throughout Pakistan, including initiatives to improve the capability and reach of provincial police and other law enforcement institutions through training, equipment, and infrastructure support. Programs will also support women's access to the justice system, as well as support the recruitment, retention, and advancement of women as police officers, prosecutors, and judges. In addition, programs will help Pakistan interdict illegal narcotics, arrest and prosecute drug traffickers, fund crop substitution and agricultural training programs for poppy farmers, and provide small-scale irrigation, hydroelectric systems, and farm-to-market roads in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province and the federally administered tribal areas. Lastly, it will promote rule of law by providing training to provincial and federal prosecutors and judges in effective trial advocacy and to corrections officials in modern prison administration. The Bureau of International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs works in more than 90 countries to help them combat crime and corruption, counter drug-related crime, improve police institutions, and promote laws and court systems that are fair and accountable. The United States is proud to work with its partner, Pakistan, to support a criminal justice system that serves and protects the people of Pakistan.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
is for.